Welcome to Healthcare Rounds, the podcast serving you the ins and outs of health policy and business topics, as well as our take on the rapidly evolving healthcare delivery ecosystem. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at the W.P. Carey School of Business and the College of Health Solutions at Arizona State University. I've been paying close attention to what's happening in telehealth these days. What started out as a project for a client has become an ongoing segment of the healthcare industry that Darwin Research Group is tracking. So, what is telehealth? There are exceptions, but telehealth companies generally focus on being either a technology provider or providing actual healthcare services by a physician. On the technology side, there are companies that provide everything from high-tech scales in the home to video-enabled carts that are wheeled from room to room in the hospital. Service providers, on the other hand, fall into two general categories: those that provide virtual house calls to people with minor conditions, so replacing an in-person visit to the clinic, and those that provide acute services to hospitals such as telestroke and telehospitalist services. The industry itself is only about 15 years young and has experienced rapid growth over the last several years. Some of the major players you might know include InTouch Health, Teladoc, SOC Telemed, and American Well. While most hospitals have adopted some mix of telemedicine services, several large health systems have developed their own programs in-house. Mercy's Virtual Care Center in Chesterfield, Missouri, is a four-story, 125,000-square-foot facility that houses more than 300 employees, many of them physicians and advanced practice clinicians. The inside of the facility, and actually you can take a virtual tour, resembles a NASA command center. Mercy says it's the largest single-hub electronic intensive care unit in the nation, providing a second set of eyes to bedside caregivers in 30 ICUs across five states. Kaiser Permanente actually has the largest primary care-focused telemedicine program in the nation. In 2016, for the first year ever, more than 50% of the interactions between Kaiser's patients and healthcare providers were done virtually. More on Kaiser in a moment. You'll also find substantial in-house telemedicine programs at Jefferson Health, Providence St. Joseph Health, Johns Hopkins, and Avira Health. In a moment, you'll hear my interview with Frank Seitz, who is leading the telemedicine efforts at Jefferson. Several factors are contributing to the rise of telehealth, depending largely on the type of service that's being provided. The rise of consumerism in healthcare, which has in part driven equally explosive growth in outpatient clinics, is what's leading more consumers to turn to their iPhones for a virtual visit. To be clear, most industry observers would agree that consumers haven't adopted telemedicine on a large scale yet, but the number of users is increasing each year. For acute services such as telestroke, virtual clinicians solve a supply and demand problem. At most hospitals, there simply aren't enough neurologists to be staffed 24/7. And when patients present in the emergency room with stroke-like symptoms, they need care fast. A four-person team of neurologists can be on call for 10 times as many hospitals and can serve multiple patients at the same time through a video cart. And then there's risk. Systems like Kaiser Permanente are responsible for managing every bit of the healthcare dollar. If virtual visits cost less than in-person visits, but offer the same level of quality, it makes sense to drive patients to telehealth. That's true whether you're a payer like Humana or an employer like Walmart. Telemedicine, we've found, is one of those industries that just screams win-win-win. Better access, lower costs, and happier patients. Isn't that what we all want? But telehealth isn't a panacea. In a widely covered story earlier this month, a California family was outraged that a doctor told their elderly relative that his lungs were failing and that he was going to die imminently via a telehealth robot. The doctor at Kaiser Permanente Medical Center told the patient, "You might not make it home," according to a local television channel, KTVU, which broke the story. The patient, Ernest Quintana, died 2 days after arriving at the hospital. The impersonal manner in which his doctor delivered the news to him and his family illustrates some of the problems that telehealth can inadvertently create. Kaiser Permanente, for its part, assumed some responsibility for the incident in a statement, but it fell short of saying more about when and under what circumstances its doctors use video cards to provide care for patients. It's time for my interview with Frank Seitz, Director of Telehealth and Jeff Connect at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals in Philadelphia. In this role, Frank is responsible for leading all internal and external growth initiatives, including all clinical, technical, support, and regulatory activities impacting the enterprise-wide telehealth program. He has served in a variety of nursing leadership roles, including Chief Nurse Executive of Good Shepherd Penn Partners, and served as Clinical Director of Emergency Nursing and Patient Progression at Pennsylvania Hospital. He has a degree in nursing from Holy Family University and a master's in healthcare administration from St. Joseph's University. Thank you for spending some time with me, Frank. You know, we recently finished a project for one of our pharma clients on telemedicine, and I thought it was big, but as I dove into the topic, I realized it was much more complex than I thought. And then there's different types of telemedicine, like telestroke, where a patient shows up in the emergency room, stroke is suspected, they wheel in a cart, and a neurologist appears on a screen. And then you have things like Teladoc, which I have through my insurance, where I can have a doctor visit by phone or on video. So I thought the best way we could get started is for you to kind of talk about the different categories or buckets of telemedicine so that we have a working understanding of the various forms of telehealth.
Sure, John. Thanks for having me. So we think at Jefferson, telehealth in broad buckets, if you will. We think of it in a world of on-demand, which is our platform for direct-to-consumer telehealth for patients that have urgent or not urgent issues that present to themselves. We here at Jefferson, I think, are relatively unique in that is that we staff our on-demand physicians with emergency physicians. So these are the same emergency physicians board certified that you'll see in our Jefferson emergency department. And, you know, why is that important, right? So, you know, a lot of folks are looking to control costs and keep people out of the EDs with ED overcrowding. And who better to assess and identify whether or not a patient is in need of seeking out emergent care in the emergency department or urgent care or, oh, by the way, to follow up with their primary care provider, you know, in the next day or so, depending on what they present with. So that's one bucket, the on-demand bucket. The other bucket we think of in large part is our scheduled visit bucket, which for us really consists of much of the established patients to our enterprise who we already have an established relationship with and for which we're looking to create, you know, ease and access of care without the patients necessarily having to get in their car and drive distantly to our location. Our president and CEO, Dr. Stephen Klasko, you know, has really identified that as a barrier to care where, you know, we know that in large academic medical centers, it's very expensive to provide care and you know, it's not always the most efficient. And what better way for a patient to receive their care than sitting at their, you know, kitchen table, having a cup of coffee, waiting to be connected to their provider. There's tons of different things that can fall into that. Things such as teletriage or virtual rounds. You already touched on telestroke. And there's different areas where we provide telehealth services. And the way that we've positioned ourselves here at Jefferson and with Jeff Connect is that those different use cases that have come up have been use cases that the end users have really found to be what they need to solve a problem for. So let me give you an example. So pre-admission testing, the nurse practitioners there found that, you know, there was long wait times, there was inefficiencies, and there's a lot of opportunities to really try to streamline the intake or history approach. And what they did was they simply scheduled histories as opposed to just a history and physical. They scheduled histories to do telehealth intake and they would spend the time that they needed with the patient. The patient didn't have to come to town. And then they also had the ability at distant Jefferson sites to be able to get their lab work, x-rays, and on the day of a procedure to have their physical completed at that time. So we found that to be a large satisfier for the patients, for the nurse practitioners as well, and we had a decreased rate of cancellation for actual surgical procedures through using that program. So we spend a lot of our time meeting with the end users, and what, you know, the way we position telehealth is it's just another tool in the tool belt. It's another mode for how we deliver care. And it doesn't mean that telehealth is everything to everyone. It isn't. It isn't meant for everything for everyone, but it's just another mode on how we can provide care for our patients here.
Do you find any resistance among the physician staff to moving in this direction, or do you find that they're generally pleased that they have this platform?
So it's a mixed bag, right? So we've spoken for 20, 30 years about early, middle, and late adopters. We're still in that mode. I could tell you, having been involved in telehealth in some form or fashion for the past 12 years, that people are more accepting and accommodating and open to the idea of completing telehealth visits to solve for whatever their, you know, office practice, clinic, or, you know, programmatic issues are. We find that there's some people that are just resistors of it. And those are probably the people that we don't spend as much time with, because the people that want to do this are open to it, are open to the education, are open to the different workflows that you need to engage with to conduct telehealth. We spend a lot of time at Jefferson providing education for our providers. We've developed modules for risk, compliance, regulatory. Why telehealth in the first place? How do you conduct a telehealth visit? So we spend a lot of time trying to educate people on the values of it. We acknowledge openly that telehealth isn't meant for everyone and everything. And we've worked to communicate with people that, you know, you should think of telehealth much the way you think of a stethoscope. It is just another tool to do a job. You know, we hear sometimes from detractors, it'll say, well, you shouldn't use telehealth for, you know, stroke or for patients having a heart attack. And then those same physicians quickly realize, ooh, telestroke has been really advantageous, and it's been written in the literature about the benefits of telestroke, telehealth modalities. You know, we find sometimes in our on-demand models with our emergency physicians that sometimes patients are at home languishing with that vague chest pain or that shortness of breath that they just can't put their fingers on. And sometimes the benefit is not necessarily that this is the most appropriate means for how to take care of a patient, but boy, what if it expedites someone making a decision to get to the emergency department to get the care that they actually need? And we find that quite often where people will call, and it's almost an arbitration, if you will, about, yeah, I'm not really sure I need to go to the emergency department or to urgent care. And sometimes just having that validating nudge behind you to say, yes, you know, you have, you know, an emergent situation, it needs to be taken care of now, could also be the difference between life and death for some of these patients. But getting back to where, you know, it's a matter of early, middle, and late adopters, we're finding that more and more people are more open and more engaging and trying to figure out what it can solve for.
Yeah, and on the flip side, you gave that example about the patient who has this nagging pain. Well, maybe it's nothing, but maybe that patient otherwise would have gotten in their car and gone to the emergency room, and all for nothing, and that physician can help triage that.
Correct, and if I expand on that just a little bit, you know, what we hear from those late adopters more often than not is we hear all these different concerns, right? So we hear, my patients don't want it. We hear that they, you know, it's not as good as an in-person visit. We hear that you can't examine the patient, that it's not reimbursable, and it's just too hard. And we hear all that, and we spend a lot of our time, John, debunking the myth, if you will, about those five things, right? So we know that patients want this, and how do we know that? So several years ago, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, there was the advisory board did a survey, and it was like maybe, you know, 3,500, 4,000 patients. And what came out, so there was 56 different indicators that they were measured on about what was the primary care attributes that were important to them. And the thing that came out on top of that list was, can I walk in and get an appointment? Am I guaranteed to be seen within, you know, 30 minutes? That rated all the way up top. So it was like, it wasn't about who their providers are and if they don't want it. Patients want it. They want care, and they want it where and when they want it, and they want it now. You know, of all these different indicators, things that were near the top of the list was price, right? Was it affordable? And then there's different indicators of validation about wanting to be seen, is my clinic or is my care provider open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? And that rated very high as well. What didn't rate nearly as high was, am I going to see the same provider every time that I need to be treated? So it wasn't necessarily about what we think is the physician-patient relationship that many providers speak about time and time again. So we've debunked the myths around whether patients want it. We've debunked some of the myths around, is it not as good as an in-person visit? And what we would say to that is it better than no visit? Because there's a lot of patients that don't pick up the phone and make that appointment to have some type of annual checkup or follow-up visit or to follow up on an issue that's been bothering them. And they say, well, you can't examine that patient as well. And we've debunked that too. And we've developed here at Jefferson and through Jeff Connect, we've developed 53 different clinical pathways about how to examine patients essentially when you don't have a stethoscope to lay on a patient, you don't have your hands to put on the patient. Part of our cohort of emergency physicians are also folks that are trained in wilderness medicine. And it sounds really crazy to say that until you realize that when you're in the wilderness, you don't necessarily have a scalpel, you don't necessarily have a stethoscope, and you really have to make good clinical judgment decisions and assessments about how to take care of the patient that's in front of you at that time. Now, we've been able to do that just as simply as, you know, let's take, for example, a patient who has asthma. Patients who have asthma present, and if, you know, there's things that they could do that before we ever assess them as clinicians, we're able to assess whether or not they're able to speak in full sentences. Do they have good skin color if you have a video assessment? Are they diaphoretic? Are they sweaty? Do they have pursed lip breathing, which is just one way that people try to hold on to oxygen? There's a lot of different things you can assess. You can also assess their environment. You can see whether or not there's a layer of dust on the counter behind them, or if there's three cats walking behind them that, oh, by the way, may be exacerbating their asthma. And boy, you can certainly ask the patient, is this the worst you've ever been before? And if it's not, what has been your indicator for whether or not you go to the emergency department in the past? And you have a lot of different things at your disposal to assess the patient. And these are all things that are better than the detractors that we talk about, the late adopters, about whether or not, you know, you can do telemedicine to take care of patients. And, you know, some of the things we communicate through our education programs is, listen, the reality is this. You pick up the phone and you give advice to friends and family right now. You do Skype or FaceTime with families, with friends. You text message with people. And you do all this without the benefit of a video assessment of the patient. And if now you are able to add another layer of how you care for a patient, in this case, the video portion of this, wouldn't you be able to take in more information and make a better assessment of what's going on with that patient? And the answer is clearly yes, time and again. So those are some of the things that we're really working through on trying to educate those detractors and, you know, those middle adopters, if you will.
Sure. And I guess to your point, I get many daily emails from different sources. And one of them I get is from Fortune. I get the healthcare daily that they put out. And this one came over, I think, yesterday. The article was entitled, Millennials Will Kill Traditional Healthcare. I'm just going to read you a little part of it. It says, quote, Millennials and their even scarier younger counterparts, Generation Z, have continued their killing streak. The victim this time is primary care and perhaps the entirety of the traditional healthcare system itself, according to a new Accenture Digital Health Consumer Survey. End quote. And in the survey, they found that 67% of millennials have a primary care doctor, and for Gen Z, that falls to 55%. And I'm quoting here from the report. It says, when thinking about non-traditional healthcare services, so walk-in or retail clinics, virtual health, on-demand services, many patients are very satisfied and extremely satisfied with the level of transparency, convenience, effectiveness, efficiency, and cost of these services. More than half of patients surveyed expect digital capabilities, and these expectations increasingly influence who patients choose in a provider. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it speaks to some of the data that I shared earlier about from the advisory board about where patients want to receive their care, and the price is important to them as well. And it's much of the focus of how we here have positioned ourselves as far as our overarching goals about how to provide care. We recognize a lot of what you just shared with us about the Gen Z and the millennials, and about 65 and 67% of them respectively have a PCP. But the question is, you know, what is that relationship? So when we speak often here about, you know, who knows the patient best, right? So most often people say, well, my provider knows me best. Well, the reality is that my physician sees me maybe 15 minutes a year on a good year. And my physician wouldn't necessarily know me personally if I didn't show up in the office and I had a gown on. We think that people want that level of care. And if we're not willing to adapt to where they are at and where they want to be, and your methodologies and quite honestly, your strategies can be much different. You can focus your Gen Z and your millennial, you know, strategy much around a telehealth program, provided you can get reimbursed for it. You may not want to have as much of a hard push on the veterans. And we realize that here. You know, we realize that our doctors only sees a portion of their total composite of their patients on any given year. The places that really know our patients best, believe it or not, is your retail clinics. It's your Walgreens. It's your Rite Aids and your CVSs of the world, right? They know pretty much everything about you. Like, let's think about that for a second, right? They know whether or not you're compliant with your statin therapies, for example. You're right. They have the pharmacy there. They know if you're fulfilling your scripts. They know if you got a flu shot this year. They know that you had bronchitis in, you know, whatever month based on whatever scripts was sent in. They know that you use reading glasses because you bought your cheaters there. They know you buy your cat litter there. They know you use or don't use coupons. They know a lot of things about you already. And oh, by the way, a lot of these retail, you know, pharmacies have clinics built in within that utilizes telehealth. Now, we've seen time and time again that they're not models that are making anybody rich, but we know that people are drawn towards them and they see that as an opportunity and as another way for them to get the care that they want.
So I'm getting way off topic here, but it just made me think of something, and you may or not want to comment on this, but I mean, in a way, the CVSs of the world could be perceived as a threat to Jefferson Health in general, and perhaps to your telemedicine program. Do you see it that way?
You know what? I personally don't. Others might feel differently. I don't feel it is a threat. I think there's complementary services that each of these programs can bring. I think that there is enough patient volume and enough needs to go around. I think the difference between what CVS is looking to do and what Jefferson Health is looking to do is really around, you know, a comprehensive care model, right? So we believe that we can deliver on the continuity of care model. We believe that we can see patients on the front side of interactions. And we know right now that in our on-demand space, that 40% of our patients that we see there are new to Jefferson. So we believe that we see, you know, a downstream effect of patients that really are looking for, you know, coordinated care, you know, and they're looking for a program that delivers on comprehensive high quality care, right? And one that delivers it where and where they want it. So we don't see the CVS. We think the CVS models provides a service that people are looking for. And we believe that we have other opportunities that give patients even more.
That makes sense. So I imagine that it's not all rosy, right? I mean, there's a lot of opportunity here. But what do you think are some of the challenges that telemedicine is facing right now?
So there's a lot. There's certainly movement on a lot of fronts, but it's an evolution. And at a high level, it's regulatory concerns. It's certainly reimbursement. It's for entities deciding to dip their toe into the telehealth world. You know, it's choice of the technologies. You know, what technology are you going to need? Are you really going to set yourself up for best of breed technology, or are you going to look for vendor of choice? You know, it's comfort. It's whether or not the providers feel comfortable with the system. And oh, by the way, do the patients feel comfortable with it? We have an entire program here of telehealth coordinators that reaches out to our patients in advance of a scheduled visit within 24 to 40 hours of a scheduled visit with one of our Jefferson providers. we do that so that we can get the patients comfortable with the technology and comfortable with this as a mode to receive their care. It also helps because then the patients are more likely to actually connect for their visit and more likely not to have issues with connecting, which, of course, keeps our providers happy because now they've been able to see their patient and they didn't lose out on that opportunity to provide care. And then probably the biggest challenge is really engaging the customers, engaging the patients to see this as a viable option for how to get, you know, their care. And that's much of the way that we continue to position with our telehealth coordinators, reaching out in advance and doing those service calls, if you will, ahead of actually a physician visit. But getting back, just, you know, I touched on it briefly, the regulatory concerns comes in a lot of different ways, right? So, you know, you have to worry about state licensure. So for physicians that work at Jefferson here in Center City, Philadelphia, that's a challenge if they have patients that are on the other side of the bridge about 5 miles away in New Jersey. So if they don't have a New Jersey license, they can't provide a telehealth visit for that patient sitting in Philadelphia. Yet, if they were to see somebody about, you know, I don't know, several hundred miles away on the other side of the state, that's okay because they're working under their medical license under the state of Pennsylvania. There's a lot of prescriptive issues. Prescribing controlled medications is a no-no. And then from a regulatory perspective, there's many conversations also around your ability to see a patient. Is the need that they have to be an established patient with the exception of urgent on-demand type care.
What about the reimbursement that you mentioned? How are visits reimbursed and what are the challenges that you face there?
So it looks different state to state. I will speak a little bit about it from our tri-state area for which we cover. So all of our on-demand physicians here for Jeff Connect cover the tri-state area being Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Delaware holds payer parity, which essentially means that the insurers need to pay the same as an in-person visit for the interaction and the time that the provider spent with the patient. In New Jersey, they have a coverage parity model, which essentially means that New Jersey now has the plum assignment of getting to negotiate with the insurers in New Jersey so that they can receive payment. In Pennsylvania, there's no parity rules or parity laws in place, which requires insurers to pay. There was a Senate bill, Senate Bill 780, that went through unanimously to the House, which would have created a coverage parity model for the state of Pennsylvania, but that was nixed with a rider that was attached to it. So we expect for that to be reintroduced once again, but that may take a little bit of time. Now, so when that happened, our president and CEO, Dr. Klasko, put his money where his mouth was for our enterprise. And he took what I think is a pretty bold step in creating a payer parity model for the 30,000 some Jefferson employees across New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And what was created was a benefit plan that essentially allowed for patients to see their established PCP, family medicine physicians, and specialists via telehealth for the same copay as an in-person visit. So essentially what was created here at Jefferson was a payer parity model for our 30,000 some employees and beneficiaries. It was taken one step further, which was, you know, in part was to create a model whereby if patients were to call for an on-demand visit with our Jefferson emergency physicians prior to making a decision to seek out urgent or emergent care, and the Jefferson emergency physicians in our on-demand space said, yes, you need to go to the emergency department. You need further workup and evaluation. Jefferson will wipe away your urgent care or your emergency room visit, provided you're seen in one of our Jefferson facilities. So that has become a game changer in a lot of ways for putting your money where your mouth is, as far as believing in the care that you provide for patients and their families.
So one final question, and then we can wrap things up. You obviously have a ton of experience in being part of the growth of telemedicine at Jefferson. And I know that we have some hospital leaders that listen to this podcast, and I also know that a lot of health systems have programs established. But just hypothetically, let's say you were to give some advice to someone who's looking into starting or expanding a telehealth initiative. What advice would you give to them?
My advice would be, you need to do this for the right reasons. And I think the right reasons are different for a lot of different organizations, but I'll give you just our perspective on it. You know, fee-for-service is here currently. If you believe that value-based care is the way that healthcare will go in the future, the ability to pivot and turn on a dime and care for those patients in a less expensive way is going to be what's really important in terms of figuring out where you're positioned for the future. You know, I would say that anybody who tells you that they are making money on telehealth is telling you a white lie. The ability to create models of care where you limit your exposure for financial risk is important. And, you know, we've worked hard to keep ourselves lean and mean here as far as our telehealth department. And we've really gone after, you know, models and areas where it makes a lot of sense that we can keep patients, you know, at home that should be at home, and then get new patients or new surgical patients into our offices where we have the ability to maximize dollars. I would say to organizations looking to do this, there's different theories. Our theory, I believe, is Big Bang. If you're going to dip your toe in the water with one group or two groups, I relatively promise you will fail. It's either a commitment to, or it's a commitment not to. The commitment to, you know, when we developed our program here at Jefferson Center City, we educated 23 departments. We educated close to about 1,100 physicians and mid-levels. And the expectation was that everybody was going to do one visit a month, because who doesn't have 15 minutes a month that they can squeeze one telehealth visit in? And as you might expect, it was met with early, middle, and late adopters. And we've seen that grow over time. And you know, those areas that have really flourished are those areas like surgery, where you can do a wound check, you know, through telehealth. And you can keep those patients that are in the bundle and that you're not making additional dollars on, you can keep them at home, you know, and you can free up additional time during your office hours that you can bring in a new surgical patient for a level 5 visit. And that's where, you know, folks can get creative with it. Probably the biggest piece that I would offer for folks who are thinking to do this, the technology, you know, and there's plenty of good technology and plenty of not so good technology out there. It really, you know, once you find good technology to do what you need it to do, you find out quickly that it's not what's going to be the difference maker. The difference maker is going to be whether or not you've really identified your workflows and you found how telehealth can be complementary to your workflows. We started out initially thinking that we needed to do this a little bit cookie cutter. And we realized that where we spend a lot of my project management team, so I have two project managers and a program manager there, where they work with each individual department to understand their workflows and to help them identify a workflow where the telehealth or the telemedicine becomes complementary and not the focal point. So those are some of the suggestions that I would give just off the top of my head, where I would say this might be some ways and some things that you want to think about as you go forward. And then the final thing I would say is, don't go it alone. Speak to a friend. Everybody knows somebody who's doing telehealth these days. There's folks out there that can really help. There's consultative services that are out there that can really help. And sometimes it's just worth doing the due diligence.
Sure. Why reinvent the wheel if there are people out there who have the experience and can prevent the pitfalls and reach out to them, right?
No, absolutely.
Well, I appreciate, again, Frank, your spending some time with me today. And I just find this topic fascinating. It's just another component of how the healthcare delivery landscape is evolving right in front of our eyes. So again, thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's all for this week. From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. If you haven't yet done so, please rate and review Healthcare Rounds wherever you listen to podcasts. Healthcare Rounds is produced by Erica DeStories and Jasmine Ledford. Music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. To learn more about us, go to darwinresearch.com or send an email to insights@darwinresearch.com. Or, if you'd like to get right to it, call us at 888-402-4000. 3465. See you next round.